So, letting go. This is the retreat. How do these two, the self and helping the self and letting go of the self, how do these two different points of view go together? How do we help ourselves and let ourselves go? We'll explore both these aspects of healthy living and seeing through the trance of our familiar prison as our meditation path, as our meditation practice both heals us and frees us. Healing and freeing. And what about this familiar prison? So the picture I have of a prison in my mind is bars, you know, so many feet of bars, and then turn a corner, and then another so many feet of bars, then turn a corner and so many feet of bars, and that's it. There's no roof and there's no back wall. That's the familiar prison of yourself. We're in this prison and we're looking, we've got our hands on the bars and we're like, I don't like this, I want more of something else. I don't want rain today. But it's not completely a prison, it's a pretend prison. We're stuck with our little sense of selves trying to make us happy, but we don't need to be. We can turn around, it's a radical turn, and we find that we're not imprisoned at all. Another thing I want to start with and insert this and refer to it as we go through is a poem. I haven't quoted this poem for quite a few years, even though I used to quote it all the time. Many of you know it well because I love it so much. It's called Dropping Keys, talking of prisons. And it goes like this. It's a Hafiz. Hafiz is a Persian mystical poet, contemporary of Rumi. 1200 and something rather he lived. The small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners. So the small man is a small mind, right? It's our little mind. Builds cages for everyone he knows. Our minds put everything in boxes. They just, this is this, this is this. We put things into little statements, into opinions. We box somebody into our opinion of them. We do it with ourselves. Things are like this. They should be like this. We're boxing everything up. While the sage, which is our true nature, our other expanded version of being able to perceive, who has to duck his head when the moon is low because it's so vast, this big aspect of ourselves, keeps. That's his practice. Keep on, keep on. That's a persistence. Keep on, because it's an ongoing way of living. It isn't just a short task. It's a way of... Keep on dropping keys all night long, all life long. This is an ongoing process. The keys that we drop keys. We allow things which were boxed into an assumption to come out. We're dropping keys all night long for, I love this last line, the beautiful rowdy prisoners, the beautiful parts of things, we allow them to come out. They were boxed in. We didn't even notice half of the beautiful things. They come out. And the rowdy stuff also, the pains, the sufferings, the humiliations, the frustrations, the rowdy. I love that word, rowdy. We're rowdy. We're not evil. We're not sinning. We've just got all this rowdy stuff in there too for all kinds of good reasons. It's a sweet, friendly poem, but it's about practicing. Beautiful poem. The small man builds cages. Say it with me because I want you to get this poem. The small man builds cages for everyone he knows, while the sage, who has to duck his head when the moon is low, keeps dropping keys all night long for the beautiful, rowdy prisoners. Thank you. So it's about dropping keys because this is about freedom. The talk is about freedom. Letting go of the sense of self means freedom. That's what freedom is. Freedom, liberation, enlightenment, realization is we realize that we have got only three sides to this prison. It's not really a very heavy prison. It's not a maximum security prison. It's very minimum security. We realize that we are the sage. We didn't realize we were a sage before. We thought we were imprisoned by a small one. And so we, in order to be able to realize our vast, brilliant beauty and the joy that goes with it and the ease that goes with it and the love that goes with it, we have to see what makes up the prison. And we have to see how we keep making up the prison and we keep believing in these three walls. To be able to see how we do it, we have to train the mind to be able to look inside at itself, steadily, penetratively, honestly, kindly. So we have to practice to train it. This is this is simple to do this practice. It's not complex. Lots of different aspects, lots of little nuance, lots of different little bits of technique. But the actual doing is not complex or difficult. You don't have to be brilliant. You don't have to have, you know, major years in school. You don't have to qualify in certain ways. You don't have to be a certain kind of wiring. What makes it hard is that it's radical. It's just not the way we normally think. And so it's so different that when the Buddha first realized what he realized, how we really are made and what the ego really does and how it traps us into this false sense of ourselves and separates us from all of life and makes us stressed all the time trying to get out of this prison that we are fabricating, he just was like, no one's going to get it. No one is going to be able to see this because it's such a radical thing. It's not complicated. It's just so different. It's so the opposite way. And he had to be convinced by the leader of the lords, of the Brahmas, up in the Deva realms, who say, oh, no, you've got to teach. Some people will get it. Even not lots of people will get it, but enough people will get this. You have to teach this stuff. Because he nearly didn't. Stephen Batchelor, who's an author, teacher, Englishman, lives in France now. He's written lots of books, very, very well written books, brilliant brain. I like his teachings a lot. Somebody said to him, his last book he wrote was about recording the Buddha, setting the Buddha in his time, in that land, in that society, and sort of putting together what he thought it must be really him as a person, what it was like and what was going on, and lovely setting. Somebody said, it's called Living with the Devil, that last book, great book. I don't know if he's got another one out more recently. Do you know that? Does anybody know? Anyway, Living with the Devil, quite an evocative book. Somebody asked him about what did he think of the Buddha. Now he has studied all of this, you know, what he was really like, what it was like to live in that era, what was going on. And he said, I think the Buddha was the most radical human being to ever walk the planet. That's what he thinks. And he's a supreme scholar, this guy, Stephen Batchelor. Meaning that the way the Buddha actually behaved and the way he actually saw was just so counter to the norm of his society. He, you know, like for one thing, for instance, he was like, to be a Brahmin, and this is in the heavy-duty caste system of, you know, India, to be a Brahmin, it's not about how you're born, it's not about what you look like or who your father was, it's about how you behave on the inside. That's really radical when you're in a caste system like that where everybody's life's completely defined by their caste. Radical, radical. Your happiness is not about what happens to you, he says. It's about how you are with what happens to you. Utterly radical. Simple, radical. So turn to the back wall that isn't there from the prison when you've spent your life clutching onto the bars and trying to get out of something is radical. Our society, a modern society particularly, maybe it's always been the case with societies, I don't know about this one, is completely focused on getting. When you're doing well, you're getting. You're achieving, you're accumulating, you're amassing, you're chasing. And if you do it successfully, you have lots of things. You have letters after your name, you have volumes of information to talk about, you have many friends on Facebook, hundreds and hundreds of friends on Facebook. You know, it's a lot. It's about getting things. I have this, I own that, I want more of this. We all know that. Achievement and accumulation, power, And when you watch yourself, when you meditate, and you're not told to watch yourself, you're told to just be here present, stay present and be with your breath, what shows up is yourself. Your selfing shows up. You see how much energy you're expending and getting and achieving and accumulating and all of that, and that's just things. And then there's all the stories you're telling. You know, you're accumulating opinions and beliefs, and we're just filling ourselves up fuller and fuller and fuller. And we get so stressed. Yeah? The other thing that we see ourselves doing, and you know it's true, is we're so always busy. I think that's one of the most defining things. When I had my first big moments of the sense of self just flashing, falling away, it was like, oh my God. The churning stopped for a moment. That busy, busy. I got an image, because I always see things in images when I have an experience. There's always some visuals going along. Some people are like that. Not everyone's like that. And I had this image. When I was a little girl, I had white mice in cages, you know. And I had an image of this mouse in his cage, like running and running and running and running, like a hamster cage, you know. So busy trying to get somewhere, getting nowhere, getting exhausted, all in the name of trying to. Of course, they're just playing, they say, in a cage, but in a hamster wheel. Okay, so it isn't just our trouble, the sense of me, it isn't just that it's busy accumulating things. That's one level. The trouble is that we completely believe we have to. That's another whole level. I mean, to have things is one thing, but to have them. And then you must get more, that drivenness. And that believing in the significance of these things that we have to get, or these opinions that we have to have, we completely invest in them. It isn't a sort of, well, maybe I'll get them and maybe I won't get them. It's like I have to. And that is translated into all addictions, people who are workaholic, you know, workaholics, or writeaholics, or looking goodaholics, or, you know, there's an obsessiveness that we have. This is what the Buddha would call clinging. We don't just like things, we cling to them. We are invested in them, we believe in them completely. That makes letting go of them trebly hard. That clinging, that believing in, really, really believing in, buying into, is the sense of self. It's like, I really believe my thoughts. I often wonder what it's like. You sit here year after year, you hear me. It's been years I've been teaching, and I know I say the same things. And today I'm really realizing I've said so many of these same things again and again. I don't know how to say it differently. I only know how to say it this way. And one of the things I've said is I have on my fridge, it still lives on my fridge, I used to take it with me to teach, my blue bumper sticker, which reads, "Don't believe everything you think." It's not just that we have thoughts and we can believe, you know, we can actually think those thoughts or not think the thoughts, it's that we believe in them. We can't see the difference between a thought and what we think of as reality. Our thought equals reality. I have an opinion about somebody. They are that way. It's real. That's clinging. That's investment. Believing in completely. Depending on, even. When we practice, we can see. The mind will see a thought. And it'll see, that's not reality. That's just a little story that's going blah, blah, blah. It's like a little movie that's running. Sometimes it's a flash of a movie. Sometimes it goes into a whole movie. But we are able to, sooner or later, see that's not reality. That's just a creation of my process here, triggered by all kinds of things. We see the difference between reality and what our minds are telling us. That's enormously significant. We know, like, some of the times we have the most difficult conflicts with people or arguments is they just don't get what we're saying. it's actually really good that they don't, because they have another reality, and it can make us, if we can use this wisely, to see this is just my version of reality that I'm trying to convince you of, and you're not being convinced. And therefore you're wrong, or you're stupid, or you're my enemy, or you're worthy of more of an argument. People see things differently. We're completely attached and clinging to our way of seeing things, our opinions, our values, our politics. We get frustrated. If the more frustrated you get, the more you know you're clinging. If you're not attached to something being a certain way, you can have an opinion about something, or you can have a taste of something. And if it's blocked in any way by anyone, they don't agree, or you can't, you know, it doesn't work out in some way, and you're frustrated, you know you were wanting, you were invested in that thing. We can all like things and have opinions of things, but if we're invested in it, we get reactive when it doesn't work. So that's how you can tell how much you're clinging, because that's where the problem lies, not in having taste, you know, preferring this or preferring that. We're all going to do that. That's normal, survival. But when it's strong enough that we have to have that happen, it's that having to which is so exhausting, and it's actually doomed, because many, many times we're not able to make it work the way we'd like, right? So that's where our trouble comes. So now I'm going to get to the letting go part. You can't actually let go. You can't let go of you-ing. Let go is, we want to, we think, okay, how do I let go? Tell me how to let go and I'll just let go. Great. How do I do that? We all want to know that. But what lets go is the you wanting anything, including wanting to let go. It's ironic, it's weird. What happens? In actual fact, and you all know this because you've all experienced it to some degree, and this just increases how that degree increases the more we practice, is when you see your thoughts, for example, you know, you see there's a thought or a little train of thoughts going on in your mind, and you're a meditator now, and you actually see that occur, and you realize that isn't reality, that's thoughts. The power of those thoughts is gone. The stickiness of those thoughts is no longer sticky. They're seen for what they really are. And when they're seen as they really are, they have no power. There's no clinging anymore. You didn't let go of anything. You just saw what was really going on there. And so you couldn't possibly cling to a phantom. A thought, when seen as not real, no longer, there's no investment there. The investing, the clinging, isn't happening. It's gone. It lets go of you. You didn't do anything. But what you did was train yourself to be able to see and keep looking. And then you realize something. When you realize something, there's nothing to be done. Oh, it's called aha moments. You realize. And something that had you in this little three-sided prison that you were clinging to has gone poof. It's like this little bubble that kept you in that little prison in that moment. The bubble bursts. You don't do anything. You don't have to do anything. It's easier than you think. One way you can help the bursting bubble is to keep questioning, is that so? Anybody here heard of Byron Katie? Her technique. She's a woman who spontaneously had big realization in a just dramatic moment in her life. American woman. And she teaches a system to help people similarly burst their bubbles of separate self. And she calls it the work. And one of the techniques she uses, because she wasn't a meditator, she was not a religious practitioner of any kind, so this sort of spontaneously, so she doesn't have any technique to train herself for this to happen. It just happened. She calls the work. And one of the main pieces of her work is people to say, is that true? Is that true? I think so and so. My partner is a such and such. Is that true, she'll say? Is that absolutely categorically 100% true? people go out, immediately they have to question their assumptions. Well, I think this is true. Then she'll say, so what would it be like if you didn't think that was true? And you see how much we build our lives out of what we're making it up to be, including this prison. I am me. I am this. I like this. I need this. I hate that. But a lot of that is being made up. It's made up for good reasons. We've had all these experiences and people in our lives and lessons we've learned and wounds we've received and achievements we've made, which all could go to build up why I feel like I am me, identified with these things. But it's mostly going on in the mind, because I, sitting here, don't actually feel any different than you sitting there feel like you. Most of it's mentally fabricated, and then we're boxed in. The small man builds cages, three-sized cages for everyone he knows, and we do it for ourselves all the time. I'm going to quote a couple of things here. I don't know, I never remember all the little, where I get all these words, but I'll read this. Watch your mind. Once we pay attention with an uncluttered mind, which is meditation, to our emotions, they lose their power and fall away. They die down like a fire will die down without fuel. It will die a natural death. And then we cease to become involved with them. So let's say you have a little rush of some kind of emotion. Somebody give me an emotion that you would have a rush with. What would you?
Anger.
Who said that? Anger, you run. So a little flush of anger comes. You're a practitioner, you're meditating, you see, here's the little flood of anger. You see, oh, a flood of anger. And you realize this is a flood of anger. Oh, anger is here. Anger feels like this. As soon as you realize, oh, this is anger, it's so unpleasant, you aren't angry. You are a person who is aware of a thing called anger. An experience with a name, anger, with these flavors. But the part of you that's not being angry, not the part of you that's not being angry, because part of you is not being angry, anger isn't living through that part of you. So anger now becomes a visitor of feeling that once you're in this position of recognizing it, it just withers away. Anger let go of you because you saw it. You didn't let go of anger. It doesn't continue when you're not angry. It's only alive when you are angry, when it's feeding through you. It's like being possessed by evil spirits. It's one of the way Eckhart Tolle talks about it. Your difficult emotions actually possess you like spirits. So anger, in a moment that you're angry, is possessing you. But when you see, oh, anger is here, it's no longer possessing you. You are now becoming a witness of a passing emotion that now becomes another thing to notice. You let go of anger, but you didn't let go of anger. Anger stopped living itself through you, and it dies away. When it dies away, there's no more anger. Just the way fires go out. The word the Buddha used to describe liberation is nibbana, and it means cool. And actually, it means like a fire going out, like a hot raging fire becomes cool. There's no more fire. It's the word that's used for when your lamp burns out of wick. You know, when the oil has gone, the thing goes out. Our sense of self goes out, and we become cool. It runs out because we are no longer believing in it. We don't let go. We is you, the individual. There is no individual, so the individual can't let go. I'll read this to you too. When we're present and we pay attention, we'll see, for instance, that thoughts are empty like sounds. Sounds are just sounds. You did some hearing practice this morning. When you disengage the thinking mind that's commenting about the sounds, where you're filling it up with meaning, and you don't do that, and you just hear sounds, they're just sounds. They're empty of meaning. We put the meaning on by thinking about them and describing them as a certain thing. But when we don't do that part, they aren't that. See the difference? We do that, we get in the way. Then we see that they don't last. They're not significant, for one thing. We're making them significant with our thinking. When we don't do that, they're not significant. Then we watch them and they just go away. They disappear, vanish, no longer real. And then we begin to see that everything's like that. Moods are like that. Flushes of anger are like that. Our ideas are like that. Our stories. Everything's like that. In fact, the whole idea of me being a person is like that. In the actual moment of experiencing, sometimes it's sunsets, there's no sense of me. Sometimes there's me wanting, resisting, doing something, and then it disappears again. That thing that I thought of was me isn't even real. That just comes and goes as a functioning thing. When this starts to be seen through meditating, we can't do it without a mind that's steady. Most people's minds aren't that steady without training them in meditation. This is what the liberation is all about, because we don't have to then keep on behaving certain ways, because we know it isn't as substantial as it was when we didn't question it. You with me? We are enslaved by the thought machine. Are you enslaved by your thought machine? Tia was when she said her mind wasn't working very well. That's what she meant, right? It's busy doing its thoughts, and we are enslaved by that process because we buy into it. The thought machine lets go its clutch when we see it's a thought machine. Jack Kornfield gave a talk once in a retreat I was at long ago. I'll never forget him doing this. He said, the mind produces thoughts just like a spaghetti factory produces spaghetti. And then he went... I just thought... I'll never forget him, like, spewing out. He was spewing. It's like, the mind is spewing. How have your minds been today? They spew out this stuff. Some of which are useful spews. We need them. We need to plan. We need to make appointments. We need to show up at work. We need to make decisions. It's not everything. It's useful skill that we can apply to certain situations, period. It isn't the total reality. When we see a thought has no inherent power, it's very, very freeing. We've just turned around, radical, and now we're looking at out the back of the prison. Oh my God, I was stuck in these years and years of hating this person, or years and years of needing something. And I just turned around and I see, where did that go? Freedom. That's freedom the Buddha's trying to teach us. It's the opposite of getting. Imprisoned. Here's another sentence. Somebody else says, conventionally, the normal, untrained way we see things, our minds are wrapped up in self-concern. Wrapped up in self-concern. I don't know if I did it for days or if I did it for a day or an afternoon, I can't remember now, but I remember saying to myself, I'm just going to watch how many thoughts have I attached to them. I could not believe it. It was about 80% of the thoughts I had. They were all about me. I like this, I don't want that. Why are they doing that to me? Why did they do that to me? I want to do it differently. It's all about me. I was just like constantly telling the story of me. I was like making me up by writing my script and creating my movie. And when I wasn't doing that, there wasn't any me there. There was sunsets there, wind in the trees there. It's like, wow. It's extraordinary. Wrapped up in self-concern and therefore unavailable, enclosed, imprisoned. When we're busily worrying about ourselves, we aren't available. You meet somebody, you're having a conversation, you're telling them something that you think is really important about you, and they're wrapped up in themselves, and they don't hear you, and they go, yeah, yeah, yeah. What does that feel like? It's hurtful. It's they're not actually there. They're all wrapped up in self-concern. How much are we wrapped up in self-concern? My image of this wrapped up in self-concern is Pigpen. You know, going stumbling down the road, all like. That's what we're doing most of the time. You don't know you're doing it because everyone's doing it and it seems normal. But you sit here quietly. Guess what you see? Pigpen. Wrapping you up. That's the opposite of love. It's impossible to love when you're wrapped up in self-concern. It's by definition. Another thing about letting go is in those moments when we see what's going on, we see we're wrapped up in self-concern, we realize, oh my God, I've been completely wrapped up in self-concern. Just seeing it, in that moment you're not. That wrapping lets go. That bubble pops. And in that moment, if you get to do this, which is a regular part of practice, you get to feel what that feels like. What being wrapped up in self-concern feels like. It's tight, it's exhausting, it's busy, it's churny, it's running in your little hamster wheel, whatever. And then when it stops, you're out of the wheel, you're out of the cage, it feels such a relief. It's relaxing. Just like you're looking at the sunset, it's relaxing. This happening of letting go, of popping the selfing, is such a rest. We are wired to be vigilant and are ready for trouble, proven by brain scans, neuroscientists. To relax isn't then our nature, isn't then our history. We actually can be completely relaxed. And the wise ones, whenever you think of being with a wise person, somebody who's inspiring, you really trust, they're relaxed. They're comfortable. They're not neurotically obsessed and wrapped up in self-concern. But to be able to do that, there's a certain trust that's required. Because we're hypervigilant, because life is unpredictable, life is difficult at times, life is very fragile. We don't know quite what's going to happen around the next corner. And somewhere or other, it's going to include pain, and eventually it's going to include death. And we have no idea how that's going to happen. It's a very insecure way of being. We're fragile, we're vulnerable, we're sensitive, and we're living in a completely unpredictable sentence. In sometimes a beautiful place, but sometimes it's awful. To trust the unfolding of life, given all of that, with the wiring that's looking for trouble, is radical. So part of meditation is soothing. Part of concentrating is soothing, reassuring, calming, settling, relaxing. You can actually sit there, as I've been instructing you, relax your face, relax your shoulders. Notice all around you there are people sitting in a calm, peaceful way. No one is edging in on your space. No one is vibing you weirdly here. We've agreed not to. We can relax. As we relax, we can not keep having to do something about something. That's part of what's required. So we have to have this friendly relaxation that comes from meditation also. Just the concentration itself can bring such a relief. We're not like, oh, okay, I've got to do this. Oh, I've forgotten to do that. Here's a little thing. So you have a lovely, big, perfect apple. And then somebody comes in and they grabs it away. And your response is you're angry because you really want the apple. When you look closely, you see it's not about apples. It's about wanting and being stopped by somebody else. It's you that's the problem. It's in you. It's in your response. We, of course, focus on apples. Meditation teaches us to start looking and being aware of it's me, it's how I am that is my happiness. It's what I'm bringing to the situation, how I'm holding and relating to the situation. If I can let go of it being about apples and be now interested in how I am, that's a really good step in the right direction. That's radical. And how am I of this situation? Just asking the question instead of assuming, hey, that's my apple. So if we can, we're trying not to fill up the space with self-concern, with me. We're trying to be further back and observe what's happening and see how things are rising and falling and coming and going and interacting and interrelating from more of a quiet, open back space where I'm not in there involved with getting and pushing and rearranging. It's a backing up. It's a quietening down. One of my teachers, Ute Janiya, he talks about we get too involved. Something happens and then I get in there and I want more of it or something. Can we be less involved? What we can let go of is so much of the involvement. You don't have to get your teeth into every scenario and put your two bits worth in and make sure it turns out a little bit more the way you like. We're involved. Notice yourself being involved and see if you can relax that involvement. When we do this, what happens is we have, I know I've said more sunset moments, but we have more moments when we're aware of what's happening, period. We're not adding, then I something, something. That's a spacious feeling, a feeling of being spacious and aware, rather than involved in getting or trying and pushing and so on. And that spacious awareness is really much more pure. Free of the little strugglings. We sort of fall into it. It's a feeling. I don't know, everyone feels it differently, but in a moment I find when I've only never said this before, but I'm seeing it this time this way, like the sense of me is encased in the walls of a bubble, like I'm this little separate bubble, and then in a moment, poof, the bubble pops, and there is no sense of me. There just is isness. And for me, that has a sense of falling back. Because for me, the sense of meing is pushing forward. It's not the same for everybody. Some people's sense of themselves is a shrinking or a tightening in, you know, an opening up. Mine is a pushing. That's how I know I'm being me. I'm always trying to manipulate things. I can tell that's my way. It's most people's way, but I can feel it when I'm doing it. I sometimes will things to do things that I want them to do, you know. Will the traffic lights to stay green. I'm on my way to the ferry. I can see it a lot in driving because of the way I manifest myself. It's a lot in driving. I will people to get out of the way if I'm hurrying.
Does it work?
What was that?
Does it work?
Oh, yes, I'm sure it works. I have no idea. I don't go as far as the outcome. I just watch the behavior is what I do. Maybe I used to go be aware of the outcome. Occasionally, if the lights are all green, I'll yippee as I roar down the road. But on the whole, it's just I see the manifestation of the selfing in that behavior. See how it for yourself. See how it does it. And when it isn't doing it. So meditation is all about learning these inner ways of how we're functioning. And then discovering from, see, mostly we learn from the, when we get in struggle, that's where we learn. Practice is realizing more and more this spacious awareness, a refuge where the mind can rest and be nourished. Our attention goes into this wider awareness rather than the noisy opinions of mind and its contents. We don't get to see clearly how we're involved in the mind and its contents because we're always like that. It's normal, so you can't tell. But when you meditate, you become more quiet. You have these moments of spaciousness. In contrast, you see how noisy it is in the mind usually. We can't tell. It's normal otherwise. So meditation gives us this broad perspective where we start to see more clearly all the confusion. So this is a book by a man called Andrew Olensky. He is Andy. We know him as Andy. He's a scholar who lives at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. He's a resident scholar in a part of it called the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. And he wrote this book called Unlimiting Mind. I'm going to read a little bit of what he says. He says it so well. Mindfulness means being present to whatever is happening here and now. When mindfulness is strong, there is no room left in the mind for wanting something else. With less liking and disliking of what arises, there's less pushing and pulling in the world, less defining of the threshold between self and other, resulting in a reduced construction of self. As the influence of self diminishes, suffering diminishes in proportion. Yeah? Comes from mindfulness. Seen because of mindfulness. And then this chapter here, I'm going to read a couple of things. He says, self is a verb. Buckminster Fuller said the same thing. Self is a verb. The English language particularly is constructed a lot around nouns. And the mind, our minds, our little minds, really like nouns, statements, this is this. But the real experience when we're watching ourselves, we are actually a functioning thing. We're not a thing, we are a function. We are a verb. You can see it inside yourself when you watch. You're not really a person, you are synapses of information being processed and producing thoughts and opinions and actions and words. It's an activity. The sense of oneself is actually activity, a verb. This is what he has to say. The core insight of the Buddhist tradition, the relentless emptiness of phenomena, has profound implications for all of us who are trying to understand the nature of life. It points to the disturbing fact that all nouns are arbitrary constructions. A person, a place, a thing is just an idea invented to freeze the fluid flow of the world into objects that can be labeled and manipulated by adroit but shallow modes of mind. Isn't that a great sentence? Adroit but shallow modes of mind, the small mind. So we can manipulate and label. So we can kind of define and explain what's happening in this peculiar, changing mush of flow of life, river. It's hard for us to tolerate this mushy flow of river because we're insecure and we don't know what's going to happen. And we're ready for trouble. So we try and make it little bits of islands of solidity so we can feel some sense of knowing what's happening, some security. It's why we do it. It's why the mind does it. Beyond and behind these snapshots we take for ourselves is a vast and unnameable process of all the nouns we use to disguise the hollowness of the human condition, none is more influential than myself. It consists of a collage of still images, name, gender, nationality, profession, enthusiasms, relationships, which are renovated from time to time, but otherwise are each a relic from one particular experience or another. The defining teaching of the Buddhist tradition that non-self is merely pointing out the limitations of this reflexive view we hold of ourselves. It's not that the self does not exist, but that it is cobbled together and transient as everything else is. The practice of meditation invites us to investigate the flux of arising and passing events. When we get the hang of it, we can begin to see how each artifact of the mind is raised and lowered to view like so many flashcards. But we can also glimpse once in a while the sleight of hand shuffling the cards and pulling them off the deck. Behind the objects lies a process. Self is a process. Self is a verb. So how do we go about selfing? This is something the Buddha looked at very closely, and he left us a trail to follow that reveals the process. Selfing is optional. I'm fast-forwarding because there's lots. I don't want to read it all. Selfing is optional. The process of constructing a self begins as an uninformed response to the texture of the ensuing feeling. Because everything we experience has a flavor. If it's pleasant, we like it. Fast forward. The making of a self is the verb. And the view of a self is its residue. So we do some, you know, I show up and I'm wanting. You know, the making of myself is the verb of wanting something. The view of it is the residue. The two become interdependent, since having a view of self will lead one to act out or create the self, which in turn will result in strengthening the view of a self, and so on. The issue is not whether the self really exists or not, but how one will regard phenomena in the moment of experience as with or without self. Hence, the Buddhist teaching of non-self is correcting a particular kind of wrong view. It's not negating the existence of an entity. The entity isn't there in the first place, self. It's just a way of functioning. What becomes clear through this analysis of moment-to-moment experience, which is what meditation is, of course, is that grasping is not something done by the self. Grasping is another word for clinging, another word for the believing in and investing in the meaning of something, is not something done by the self, but rather self is something done by grasping. When we grasp, we are creating ourselves by the grasping, by the chasing. Self is constructed each moment for the simple purpose of providing the one who does the liking or doesn't like. It holds on or pushes away what's unfolding in experience. Just as there is a fundamental interdependence between consciousness and its object, there's also a fundamental interdependence between desire and its subject. So desiring, the verb, creates the sense that you are doing the desiring. It's actually just desiring. You don't have to be with me with all of this. I just wanted to offer this to you because I love how he describes it. It's very hard to put into words. He's a scholar, so he does a good job. But you don't have to even listen to anyone else. What we have to do, if we want to come out of this three-sided prison, which we don't need to be in, and be stressed and struggling, wanting happiness where it's unfindable, real, deep, true, long-lasting happiness where it's unfindable, is we have to practice. We have to meditate. We have to calm the mind down. We have to cheer the mind up, reassure it. And we have to then steady the gaze and look and see what on earth is going on inside. Because it's what's going on inside that will make you happy or not outside. And if you do that, you will see where you are causing yourself stress and where, therefore, you don't need to. That's it. Do the practice, and the practice does the work of freeing us. We don't free ourselves. We don't let go of anything. By seeing our wrong view, we won't be held in it. It's impossible. It's a dissolving thing that happens. And it feels good. And you know it, because we've all experienced it many, many times in many, many moments. Those moments grow, become more accessible, more reliable, more frequent, longer. It's a process. So that's that. I want to change the topic a little simply to say that now you're going to go home. So how do you take, I always have to address this, of course, how do you take any of this practicing, being here together in the support of each other in a, you know, the container of a retreat and live with this? How do you do this in your life? And so there's a few things I just always have to say which really, really support some of this understanding and this ability to contain your mind, calm your mind down. Practice every single day. Regardless of what it looks like, regardless of what happens, regardless of how successful you are or how well behaved or not your mind is, how your mind is or isn't working, regardless of anything, sit every day for a period of time. Minimum 15 minutes. 15 minutes is good. I heard somebody recently say 5, 5, and 5. 5 minutes for every day for 5 days, and do that for 5 weeks, and you've got to practice. But I think 5 minutes is a bit too little. I think 15. You'll find
5 minutes.
5 minutes, 5 days a week for 5 weeks, like 5 out of 7. You know, so do. That's good enough. Whatever. Try and practice every day by being sitting. Be still. Some people, it's when they're walking the dog, which is also very valid. Don't expect it to look like anything. And my main piece of advice is, it isn't to get anything. We're not getting. It's actually the opposite. It's a letting go of all the getting that you're getting. It's stopping that whole wanting and trying and fixing an agenda and all of it. It's time out from all of that. It's being. It's also a relief because it's a rest. It's time out. It's time off. It's like the legalized lunch break, coffee break. I often do it with a cup of tea. But you're not doing anything. You're just being here again. Be present. It's not doing. It's much less. Here you are, you're being, you're hearing sounds, you're watching the birds, you're being with your body, and it's breathing, and it's aching, you're being here. Do much less. Enjoy the time out. Give it to yourself as a gift, as a break from all the other neurosis and running in the hamster wheel that we do all the rest of the time. That way, it's not one more task to add to the list of tasks, which won't get attended to, because the others seem much more productive, because they are productive. This isn't productive. Lots of S words help you. Take some time in silence. Take some time in simplicity. Be slow. Make space. Sitting. What other words have I got? I mean, eat a meal silently every so often. Stop. Stand instead of walk. It's like just, it's less, 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 less everywhere. Really, really, really necessary for all of us to be supported, to get support, to share this, to be with others somehow or other. Million ways these days and through the internet, unbelievable. Download Dharma Talks, incredible. You can have guided sessions. You can put your computer on and you can have them talk you through a meditation sitting. You can get gongs. You can get a whole array of beautiful gongs for your phone to help you be here. Have it do every 5 minutes to kind of chime to make sure you're in your body. I mean, it's amazing. Fabulous talks, huge resources. Start Googling online Vipassana talks, Dharma talks. Through any of the sites you know, just start through Victoria Insight Meditation, which you already know because you've all registered through that. And just look for links and off you go. It's a whole wealth of beautiful support. YouTube, like 10-minute things on YouTube about freedom. And there's some junk there too, but there's some good stuff. Take retreat regularly, like you are doing. And most of you already know this, which is why you're here. This isn't the first time for most of you. It just helps. It just like reinforces what you already know, you understand, but you've forgotten somehow. It's got a little bit vague and a bit thin. So take retreats. I really encourage, and I encourage residential retreats. I definitely encourage residential retreats. If you can take several days together in a residential facility and really turn the phone off completely, and the effects are amazing, exponentially valuable, you know, if you take numbers of days. Highly, highly recommended. I teach lots of retreats. Starting next Saturday, I'm teaching a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock. The effects, when you watch people do that, what happens to their minds, it's remarkable. It's awesome. Beautiful. You just really get it way more than you can. 1 + 1 = 2 days. But if you do 2 residential days, it's like 4. It's incredible. Because the mind is trainable. That's the thing. And so it really, really gets, when you can train it, like it really, really gets quiet. It really sees really clearly. It's awesome. Highly recommend that. Okay.